Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you with us. Todd Rehm is with us. And Todd, you chose that music, which we're playing right now. And before we talk about serious matters, what is that music and why is it relevant today?
The song is called Oh Yeah by a group called Yellow, and it is used throughout Ferris Bueller's Day Off as punctuation. And today is the 32nd anniversary of the release of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which for my generation is probably the most important movie of that period.
Wow. Well, Todd Rehm, we appreciate your giving us...
I'm constantly reminded how uncool I am.
You and me both. That, of course, is State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver. She represents Decatur in the Georgia legislature. Thank you for being here today, Mary Margaret. Jim Galloway, of course, the lead political writer for the AJC. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the newspaper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia, part of myajc.com. Thanks for being here, Mr. Galloway.
Wouldn't miss it.
Since last we saw you, you have been to see Hamilton.
Yes, I have become an addict. I am an addict.
The next thing you know, Galloway is going to be participating in these Hamilton nights where people come together and sing songs from the musical.
But just it was appropriate because we went to see it, and just as we were going to see it, the Casey Kegel recording was coming out, and we knew that somebody had been in the room where it happened.
All right. Joining us from NPR in Washington, Kyle Hayes. He is the founder and oversees Peach Pod, a really terrific podcast about Georgia politics. Kyle, you are a Georgia kid, but you're now up there working in Washington, yet you keep your finger on the pulse of what's happening here. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's great to be back. And yeah, I love following what's going on in Atlanta. Change of pace from here in Washington.
Yeah, well, we have plenty to talk about. I always should say, though, Todd, I asked you to talk about the music, but I should remind people you are a Republican strategist. You are also the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, which is a terrific way to keep on top of what's happening in particularly state and local politics. You get into those local issues that a lot of people ignore. So we're glad you do that. You keep us with plenty to talk about.
I get deep into the weeds and stay there for hours at a time.
I do want to say one thing. We had a tremendous night in Columbus, Georgia, and the reception we got from all of you who came out was so gratifying to us. Thank you all. Thank you to the River Center for providing us with such a great venue. I just don't want to let this show go by without mentioning that. I should also tell you that, of course, you can watch us on Facebook Live right now if you go to the GPB News page on Facebook. That Columbus show was viewed by 6,343 people watched at one point or another during the live show or afterward. It was shared well over 100 times. It was just remarkable. And our Facebook Live traffic is picking up substantially. And we invite you to join us and to leave your comments when you do. And you can also tweet us at PoliticsGPB. All right, enough of the commercials. So, Jim, just as we were getting set to go on the air Thursday night, Greg Bluestein, and Richard Belcher over at Channel 2 broke this story about Casey Kegel, the secret recording that Clay Tippins, one of his rivals in the GOP primaries, made that revealed some information about Kegel talking about the bill that would increase the ceiling for public for funding of private scholarships. Tell us, and we didn't talk about it because we didn't have enough information.
Right.
Let's dig into it now.
Okay, the first thing, just as a backstory, very quickly, Lindsey Tippins, who is my state senator out in West Cobb, back in April, just before the legislative session ended, resigned as chairman of the Senate Education Committee, citing a difference over HB 787, which is the bill that you mentioned on raising the state funding for charter schools. Okay, so set that aside. On May 24th, 2 days after the May primary was over, which resulted in a runoff between Casey Cagle and Brian Kemp, the fourth place finisher, Clay Tippins, walked into a meeting with Casey Cagle. The topic, obviously, was, will you endorse me? And in Clay Tippins' pocket was an iPhone, and that iPhone was on record.
Clay Tippins being Lindsay Tippins' nephew.
Right.
The feeling, Todd Rehm, is that Clay Tippins, and perhaps Lindsay Tippins as well, I haven't talked to Lindsay, believed that they were betrayed. They thought they had a deal with the lieutenant governor that he would not allow the ceiling on that money to go as high as it eventually did, $100 million. And they felt betrayed by that. And Clay Tippins clearly went in there hoping that he was going to get some kind of dirt, and boy, did he! Right, fair enough, Todd.
I think that's accurate, but I think two things are going to happen. One is that we're going to see a lessening of the willingness of politicians to have frank conversations because this highlights the fact that everybody carries around a voice memo recorder in their pockets. The second thing that I think is going to happen is that within a week or so, this will largely have blown out of the news media, and it'll be down to who has the money to be up on television. And that's where I think, you know, Casey Cagle at that point probably has a distinct advantage, if not an insuperable one.
All right. So let's, before we get to the consequences, Mary Margaret, here's one of the things that Casey Cagle. Clay Tippins said, why did you do this to my uncle? Lindsay, we thought you had a deal with my uncle that you weren't going to let the ceiling go so high. And one of the things that Cagle said, and it's in the transcript that the AJC printed, the Channel 2 put on the air, exactly the reason I told Lindsay, Cagle says to Clay, it ain't about public policy, it's about expletive politics. There's a group that was getting ready to put $3 million behind Hunter Hill, Mr. Pro-Charters, vouchers. So Cagle admits on this tape, Mary Margaret, that there was political motivation. He did not want Hunter Hill, who was a pretty significant rival in that primary, to get the kind of funding that might have put him in the runoff. And so he took the issue away from Hunter Hill.
It's not shocking that politicians can be hypocritical. It's not a shock. But it's also true that in the Capitol, there are people that you don't trust and people you do trust. And I don't think that Clay Tippins, new to politics, had much trust of anybody in politics. And the constant theme, the constant hammering, politics is bad and throw them out and the bad guys need to go, could have been part of Clay Tippins' anger at how he was treated, how anger at not being able to raise the money. Casey Cagle is wrong to raise that $100 million for private school scholarships. It's not charter school. It's private school scholarships. Knowing that it's bad policy, particularly for the poor children of Georgia whose education needs are not being met. It's a very sad situation, though, when the distrust of politicians is proven again and again and again by politicians themselves.
So, Kyle, let me get you into the conversation. It isn't shocking that politicians behave like politicians, but this kind of blatant example, this evidence of how political they can become, do you think voters have a right to be concerned about it?
Yeah, I definitely think they have a right to be concerned. You know, this is a lot of the messaging that was put together by Cagle's opponents in the first round of this Republican primary, that this was the kind of politics that they didn't like, and it was something that they tagged him with when they called him a career politician. So they're certainly within their right to be concerned. I think it's interesting in this instance that it's just so blatant, and you don't usually get these sort of admissions on tape in a way that we have in this situation.
No, it's actually, you know, you have this is a morality play on two levels. If you're Casey Cagle, you're saying, how dare somebody record my private conversation without knowing it, and that's wrong, okay? And if you're not Casey Cagle, if you're in the other camp or just a voter outside, you're saying, well, there was something that I needed to know about Casey Cagle that wasn't coming through, and I wasn't going to get it any other way. So I'm okay with that.
Clay Tibbins didn't believe Casey Cagle was going to be truthful. He didn't believe he'd be truthful, and he wanted to have that tape to understand whether or not he could be truthful. I think it's very sad, and it's really wrong for, the children who need an education funding in the state of Georgia. It's particularly disconcerting to me, though, because I do believe, I see this in my law practice every single day, the single consent rule of Georgia that you can tape anybody without their knowledge and consent. And in formalized disputes in court where evidence is going to be put forth, I see it fairly often. In the state capitol, for everybody to be carrying around their phone, taping each other, is very disheartening. And I believe it has to do with their people who won't tell the truth down there.
And to Mary Margaret's point here, Bill, there are two bills here. There's the SSO, the student scholarship, which is one thing. Then there's 787, which was the direct payments from the state to charter schools. And what Lindsay Tippins' objection was, Lindsay Tippins is, I mean, look, he comes from West Cobb. That is a very conservative territory.
Former school board member.
Yes, former school board member. He is not a liberal here, but he is a public school guy. And his objection to charter schools is that they're not taking the same students that public schools are taking, and yet they're wanting more money. This bill that is at the center of this fight, it was raising rates, money paid to charter schools per student in a fashion that is greater than 46 school systems throughout Georgia.
I'm glad you corrected me, because I kept calling it the scholarship fund. That's separate. This is very specifically about the charter schools. And what that means, Todd, is it is money that would not go into the public school coffers.
Yes, but it's also taking care of students who also won't be drawing from the public school coffers. And there are those in the charter school movement who will always correct you if you say that a charter school is not a public school, because it is. It's just got some, you just have to get into it. I've got a couple points on this. One is that I think that despite the appearance of this being a bad thing, I think this is actually good politics. I feel like Gordon Gekko giving his "greed is good" speech. But if we want to believe that our participation as citizens in the political process of asking and demanding and all that stuff, politicians to do what we want them to do, is a good thing, this should serve as an example of how that can actually work. It might be distasteful to some, but it's a politician making his decision not just on his own opinion of what is good policy or what's bad policy, but what a substantial portion of his electorate wants him to do.
Well, I didn't read it. Kyle, let me get you back in. Todd's interpretation of that is interesting,
right?
Because I think, based on the transcripts that I read, Casey Cagle is saying very specifically that there was an organization ready to put $3 million into Hunter Hill's campaign because he was an advocate for increasing the money to charter schools, and Casey Cagle wanted to preempt that.
Is that true, by the way? Does anybody know whether that's true, that Walton was going to give $3 million Hunter Hill?
I want to say this. That $3 million doesn't matter if there's not a substantial portion of the Republican electorate that wants more support of charter schools and more support of private schools.
All right. Well, okay. So let's just let that lie on the table for a minute. Kyle, here's the next question, and Todd sort of alluded to it. We in the media looked at this story and found it to be a great headline. It is. We saw it as a very big deal. It was the news of the weekend. People were following Casey Cagle to see how he'd respond. But Kyle, in the long run, what kind of impact is this story going to have on the voters of Georgia, in your opinion?
I think the jury is out on that. I think the way in which this is bad for Cagle is it contributes to the perception that Cagle's opponents already have of him, that, you know, they might call him a self-dealing politician based on this tape, but they were saying things about him about that earlier in the race. So, you know, the thing that I think may be the difference in this race is enthusiasm to vote in a late summer runoff. And if this angers Kemp supporters enough, and it angers former supporters of Hunter Hill and Michael Williams and Clay Tippins, you know, those voters are probably not going to go to the polls to vote for Cagle, but they may go now to vote for Brian Kemp if they find this conduct from Cagle to be unseemly.
Yeah. What you had before this broke, you had Kemp really trying to position himself as the true conservative on a number of issues, whether it was guns or whatever. And now you've got yet another talking point, another issue on the swamp of the state capitol.
But those talking points really only work if you have the money to get them in the
air. Well, there is the key. And Mary Margaret, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about. This story, at a certain point, the media is going to play this story out. It'll only keep getting headlines for a shorter period of time, most likely, unless something new develops. And at the moment when the free media stops paying attention to it, somebody else has to fill in, if you want to go after Cagle, the gap. And Brian Kemp doesn't have the money to do that.
I don't know whether he has the money or not. I listened to all this conversation in the era of 2018 where the ground is so uncertain. I don't think we have a lot of real good information about what's happening out there. This is a distasteful story. It shows people tell the truth. It shows that people are angry about somebody not telling the truth. And I believe that will have an impact. I'm not sure who it touches the most at this point, but it will have an impact.
But in the meantime, Casey Cagle has plenty of money to put up yet another TV ad attacking Brian Kemp. Let's listen to this spot. And before we do, just the setup, Cagle's people have found what they think is a Brian Kemp lookalike. I don't quite see the resemblance myself, but that's fine. He's sitting in a pickup truck like Brian Kemp was in, standing by his pickup in one of his TV spots, talking to an older woman, and this is what happens.
I'm Brian Kemp, and I'm running for governor.
The Secretary of State, who's supposed to be protecting the voters' confidential information?
Yes, ma'am.
The same Brian Kemp that made our confidential information public.
Including
the Social Security numbers of 6 million Georgia voters. And you got caught covering it up.
Oh, okay. Well,
shame on you, Brian Kemp. Get that big truck out of here.
Brian Kemp, incompetent, untrustworthy.
So, Kyle, as long as Casey Cagle has all the money he needs to continue pounding away at Brian Kemp, and Brian Kemp doesn't have the money to keep the secret tape story alive, it seems advantage Cagle to me. What do you think?
It does seem like it's advantage Cagle, and I don't know that this actually changed Cagle's approach that much, because he was out with an ad that y'all may have talked about previously, questioning an agricultural deal that Kemp was a investor of, a company with an agriculture issue in Kentucky. So I think Cagle, his strategy, it appears to be, was to come out of the gate pretty hard in this runoff and try to maybe push Brian Kemp out of the conversation. I think the one thing that this tape does do is it's not going to allow us to think that this race is over before we get to the runoff, given that this tape is out there.
But, Jim, the real point here is, of course, that Cagle has the money to keep doing this over and over again.
Cagle has the money for right now. But then there's the matter of this recording. And does that recording embolden people who would otherwise have stayed out of a Republican runoff? And do they start sending money the way of Brian Kemp?
As far as the money, I don't think that it's going to affect most of the folks who make large donations, because they're making large donations on the basis of who they think is most likely to win. I did want to mention that this is the second time we've had a private discussion released in the last couple weeks, with Jeff Duncan having dropped some texts between him and Rick Jeffers on Twitter recently, and this is an important change in the culture of politics, and the deprecation of the old code of omerta, or as it's known under the Gold Dome, the bro code.
Mary Margaret, I want to come back at you with something you've said and ask you to speak to it a little bit more. It strikes me as a citizen that it is perfectly fine for me to be able to hear recordings of how you and your colleagues are conducting your business under the Gold Dome. You suggest that you think the culture is changing for the worse if people are going to run around with their iPhones set to record. But in fact, why should we not expect that what those recordings would pick up is nothing but really legitimate issue-oriented conversations, and even the occasional horse trading that certainly is part of your work?
The climate is not attractive, and the climate is always going to be intensely competitive. But I go back to the issue of, are you going to tell the truth or not? And there are people down there who do not tell the truth. And I want the public to know that. I do want the public to know that. I watch my colleagues every day vote for things that I know they don't believe in. And they'll say they don't believe in it. I want their constituents to know that they're voting for things they do not believe in. And that hurts every one of us in Georgia and every one of us under the Gold Dome. Particularly some of the women Republicans come and they're very upset. They're tearful. I don't want to vote for this. A social conservative issue might be gay people, might be abortion issue. I don't want to vote for this. Do something. Do something. And I say back, well, then don't vote for it if you don't want to vote for it.
All right, let me, Jim, we're going to have to get to a break. Very quickly before we do, this weekend, Casey Cagle was back up in Gainesville, his home territory. Point out in the Jolt today, Gainesville newspaper had a pretty tough editorial about him.
It was a very stern one. I mean, the kicker line was we deserved better. But, you know, they pointed out that education is Casey Cagle's top priority. He was clearly willing to trade it away, and they broached the question of, okay, what about issues he doesn't care about that much?
All right, we will continue to watch this story unfold because it is probably not going away anytime too soon, and we'll just keep our eye on it. In the meantime, we've got to get to a break. Jess, on purpose, by the way, did send us a Facebook post saying, why can't people just stick to the facts and not do dirty politics? Well, politics ain't beanbag, and what would we talk about on this show if they did what you're suggesting, Jess? This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Drive so far.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm here in the studio with State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, political consultant and editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, Todd Rehm. Kyle Hayes of Peach Podcast is in Washington in the NPR studios to talk with us. And Jim Galloway is here because it's Monday. Before we completely leave Cagle, Jim, give us a little, if you can, very concise. Your folks interviewed him over the weekend about this. How did he spin it?
Basically, he said when he was talking about defining this as bad policy, he was trying to put those words into Lindsay Tippin's mouth rather than his own. Tippins has told us that that's not the case, and that it wasn't really as bad as it sounded.
All right. Well, again, we will watch this story unfold in the days ahead. Let's turn to another story. You know, actually, there are two stories that have a theme in common. Both of them relate to the federal courts. First of all, the one that is closest to home, Jim, a three-judge district court panel has ruled, at least initially ruled, on a request for an injunction that would have stopped the current elections, the upcoming elections in Gwinnett and Henry counties for legislative seats. Representative Joyce Chandler, former state representative Brian Strickland, the allegation from the ACLU is that they were in districts that were redrawn in an off census year cycle to increase GOP voting strength because those districts were turning Democratic. And the ACLU claimed that these districts were actually redrawn with racial motivations. Yeah,
right, right. And if you go back to the Democratic primary for governor, this is what Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams were fighting about, because this happened when Stacey Abrams was the House Minority Leader, and it was the contents of this redistricting bill really wasn't discovered until after the vote. After the vote in the House, it became a big issue when it got to the Senate, but it wasn't there was no way it was going to be stopped by then. Historically speaking, you're not going to find a whole lot of federal judges who are going to stop an election in process. I think that's the first thing to say. But yet it was unusual in that they said that there was compelling evidence of racial discrimination, and yet they weren't going to stop the process.
So, Mary Margaret, that's one of the most interesting things about this ruling. Yes, they said, the court said, it does look like race played a role in this. And, of course, it's illegal to create district lines around race. But it's not illegal so far to create lines based on partisanship. So the court said, you know, maybe they did this in part because they were just trying to get a lot of Republicans in the district, and they knew it was unlikely African Americans were going to be supporting the Republicans.
Judge Martin making a finding that there's compelling evidence of racial discrimination, I think, is a very significant statement. The fact that the other two judges on the panel, Judge Duffy and Judge Batten, weren't really willing to accept that as a reason to stop an election in progress is not that surprising. The big picture here is that there are two more Mondays left of the United States Supreme Court decisions to be revealed. And we all know that the gerrymandering decisions of Maryland, Wisconsin, and Texas are going to be coming forth in a major decision from the United States Supreme Court, either next Monday or the Monday after. And the issue of partisan gerrymandering is going to be addressed. Racial discrimination is illegal. Partisan discrimination is not quite yet illegal, and that a court is going to give us some decision, some guidelines about partisan discrimination.
Right. You've had Judge Kennedy lay down some very, very broad hints that there ought to be some rules on where is the red line on a political party in power. Its ability to choose the voters that will in turn choose it.
Yes, but Kyle, the courts in general have in the past, and this is one of the reasons this ruling, this decision when it comes out is going to be so fascinating, a little reluctant to interfere with what they see as a political process. It's one thing to say, yes, it's illegal to redistrict based on race. We get that. It's a violation of civil rights, among other things. But partisanship is another matter entirely. And that makes the decision by the court a little bit more difficult. Yes?
Right. I think the court has been looking for some sort of mechanism, some sort of test that they could use to have some sort of record of how partisan a gerrymander is. I think the interesting thing as that Supreme Court case relates to this Georgia case is the state's argument for why they did this redistricting was that it was partisan in nature. They wanted to make these districts more likely to elect Republicans. And I think in some of the other cases where they've judge partisan gerrymandering, the state or the officials involved say, no, this wasn't about partisan issues, it was other things. And so if the Supreme Court rules later in this term that partisan gerrymandering is not allowed, do we come back to this case where the state officials and the state staffers that worked on this said, yes, the point was to make it easier to elect Republicans? Do we come back and revisit that decision anytime soon?
The factual issue underlying all of this is that over the last 12 elections, African American voters have cast roughly 90% of their votes for Democratic candidates. And so it's almost impossible to separate out partisanship and skin color, especially in the state of Georgia, when if you're trying to move Democratic voters, one of the surest, 90% accuracy signs is their skin color. And the way it's been over the last few redistricting decisions, all you have to do is make the assertion that you're doing it for partisanship instead of for racial reasons, because it's so hard to separate out the two.
When there's a real trial, and not a preliminary injunction, not a temporary restraining order type hearing, when there's a real trial, you're not going to be able to refute the evidence in Henry County and Gwinnett County that the gerrymandering done for Joyce Chandler and Brian Strickland was based on race. They moved black voters out They moved black voters around for the purpose of creating a district that was more white and more Republican. That is something that is maybe unique in some ways to Georgia or the South in our redistricting processes, but the United States Supreme Court is going to give us some guidance. And I do not believe that they are able to deny that in some cases the facts of partisanship and racial discrimination are the same. And simply saying it's to elect a Republican, it refutes the facts.
Right. Mary Margaret, there's a fourth case out there. You spoke of Maryland, Wisconsin, and Texas. There's a fourth case out there that has some Atlanta roots, and that's a challenge to the redistricting in North Carolina, of course. The Bondurant firm is behind
that. Yeah, Emmett Bondurant is involved in that one.
Right, and you've got what's interesting in that case, I hope I don't get the academic institution wrong, but I think it's the Duke University Mathematics Department has come up with a formula that was presented in front of the U.S. Supreme Court on how to measure partisan gerrymandering and when it crosses the line. And it'll be interesting to see if they begin to embrace that.
But Kyle, if it is conceivable that the Supreme Court ruling, should it go in the direction of saying that partisan gerrymandering is illegal, too, would make the question of whether what happened in Gwinnett and Henry counties is racial or partisan moot. Both of them would be illegal if the court rules, yes?
Right. And the interesting thing about how race and partisanship interacted in this case is that the data on race on sort of like a street level view of, you know, you use these programs to kind of draw district lines and you can move it over by a street or a block at one time. And the data about race was more granular than the data about partisanship. And so, you know, what's discussed in the opinion is whether or not the state staff that were redoing these maps were sort of using race to some extent as some inference in partisanship because of this tight link that we've talked about between African Americans tending to vote for the Democratic Party. I think both would be out of line. I think it's just a question of then when do you implement that because we have elections coming up.
You know, Todd, it's interesting to me, and I always, when we talk redistricting, right now the Republican Party is in control, certainly of this state government and of many governments in the United States. So the gerrymandering tends to be in Republicans' favor. I always want to point out that when Democrats are in power, they gerrymander in favor of Democratic districts.
In fact, Bill, the Maryland case that
is a Democratic case.
Exactly.
That's exactly right. But here's an interesting question, Todd. If Democrats are putting African-American voters, packing them into a district as a way of hoping to increase their advantage in a given district, that too could be questioned as a possibly racial gerrymandering in reverse. I'm not sure I understand the distinctions of the law as to whether gerrymandering only is an issue if you're subtracting rather than adding.
there has historically been a second set of competition other than just Republicans against Democrats in terms of redistricting. In the early 1990s, the primary divide was in some ways white Democrats, rural Democrats in Georgia versus African-American Democrats. And in that case, in those years, you had some African-American legislators and some Republicans working together to increase the number of majority or the number of districts that were likely to elect an African-American as the Democratic nominee.
Right,
because
right.
That's a second part of the calculus when you talk about the percentage of voters in a district that meet this criteria or that criteria is not just how does that affect the general election, but how does it affect the likely winner of a partisan primary?
And in the 1990s, that's how Newt Gingrich secured his congressional district at the same time that Cynthia McKinney, a Democrat, an African-American Democrat, secured hers.
Precisely.
But I think we can agree those days are over. The issues now are more complex. They're more compelling. The chasm of our divide is based on gerrymandering and money. I think the public understands that. The way in which the public has come to pay attention to districting lines is fascinating to me. They understand right now what's broken in our politics is gerrymandering and money.
Meanwhile, Kyle, while we stick to the courts and voting issues, the Supreme Court of the United States released a decision on a case that a lot of people have been following very closely. They upheld an Ohio process which purges voters from the rolls up there at a faster pace, more precipitously than any other state in the union, and they ruled in Ohio's favor, saying Ohio has the right to purge voters under the process they're using. I don't know if you've had a chance to absorb this because it came out late this morning. Yeah, what can you tell us?
I think the interesting thing as it ties into our discussion is that Georgia has a similar process, and I think Georgia's may purge voters in a slower time period than Ohio's does. So it certainly protects Georgia's process from a constitutional perspective. The complaint that's made about this process often by voting rights advocates is that the purges disproportionately affect voters of color and voters who tend to be low income. And so this is similar to voter ID and other regulations on voting that are argued by conservatives as being benign. Everybody has to comply with them. The voting rights proponents argue that these are actually meant to target voters that tend to vote Democratic or voters who are lower income or minority. And so that will be interesting to watch as we're coming up again on an election.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Let me, Mary Margaret, and that's what Kyle's saying is exactly right. There are people out there. Number one, the data does show that African-American minority voters are disproportionately affected by voter purges like this. So there are those critics of Ohio's system that claim this is another example of attempts at voter suppression.
Voter suppression is also something that irritates the citizens in the way politicians who don't tell the truth irritates the public. Voter suppression is a constant theme brought forward by the Republican Party. Taking out Saturday voting, taking out Sunday voting, taking out early voting. Well, those are fights every single day. We had a lawsuit here in Georgia, Brian Kemp wanting to purge the in a more narrow way than Ohio, and the settlement was that he was not going to do that. This case, unfortunately written by Justice Alito, is very, very unfortunate, I think, for those who want to vote to suppress voter participation.
We've had a discussion going on in Georgia politics over the last year, driven by Stacey Abrams' candidacy about the Democratic need to seek out those reluctant voters, those occasional voters, and what something like this is going to do over I'd say the next next 4 or 5 6 election cycles. It's going to require the Democratic Party to really to build a constant GOTV effort rather than something that happens every other year. They're going to have to keep a list of voters and remind them every single time that they need to get out.
I think the need for 24/7 get out the vote is not just something that the Democrats are going to have to think about. I think this is something that Republicans are also considering how best to do that, especially given the human nature of ignoring something once you've been told about it 27 times in the last 6 weeks.
All right. Well, I've got to get another break in. As we go to break, I want to I think most of you by now have heard the news, but it's worth repeating. You have been so enthusiastic about Political Rewind out there and have shown us how much the show means to you, which is, first of all, it's gratifying as it can be to all of us who have worked on the show for 4 years. But your interest has finally gotten us to act again. We are going to expand the show to 4 days a week, starting the day before the runoff election, July 23rd. And we will be on the air starting that week on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, all at 2 o'clock. Two-Way Street will continue at 2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, because you got to have a little art and culture in your life. It can't all be about politics, but we will be on the air 4 days a week, and you're the reason. You have made this show the success that I am really proud to say it's become. So I hope you'll stick with us for all of that. Let's take our break, and we'll be back with more.
On the next Fresh Air, the powers, perversions, and potential of heredity. New York Times science columnist Carl Zimmer tells us how current state-of-the-art genetic research can help us understand the absurdity of racism, change the genetic makeup of an embryo before it's implanted, and potentially eliminate some diseases. His new book is She Has Her Mother's Laugh. Join us.
Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
We are back on Political Rewind. Kyle Hayes is with us in our Washington, in the NPR studios of Washington. Kyle, I mentioned Peach Pod. Let me give you an opportunity while you have the floor to tell us what's in your latest podcast.
Well, the next one that we're doing, we're going to put one out really soon. We're going to look back at this Kegel tape discussion that a lot of similar to what we've had today. But we're also going to talk about the issue of immigration going on in Washington. There's a lot of big debates over solving the issue of the Dreamers and new policies in place from the Trump administration on the border that I find pretty punitive against immigrants.
Well,
that's what's coming up.
I'm glad you mentioned that because we are expecting. We've had this discharge petition that's been circulated by a bipartisan group of members of the House trying to get immigration legislation to the floor. The Speaker has said he's going to find a way to do some kind of compromise that'll get it there, but they better get to it fast, right?
Right. I think time is running out. There's some procedural issues involved with the way that discharge petitions work. And there's resistance from Republican leadership in Washington to wanting to let a discharge petition succeed. So that's a pretty complicated moving situation from the last time I checked in on it.
All right. And Todd Rehm, while we're talking about giving people a chance to mention the work they do, GeorgiaPundit.com, in addition to the news you have of political world locally and in the state, and in addition to the dog adoptions, you have wonderful pictures of cute dogs that are looking for a home. But you also do some great history pieces. We talked about Ferris Bueller, but this is also a very important anniversary in politics, and you mentioned it on your website today.
And I totally forgot it.
It's March 1963. Do you remember what it is now? Because I'm forgetting what it was, too. All right, you look it up and we'll
but
come.
But as long as we're talking about history, I was in Columbus scouting out the site for y'all, and I found a previously undocumented monument to the first Memorial Day ever, which occurred in Columbus, Georgia. And I'm going to be writing about that in the next couple weeks as I get it together.
All right. Well, you know, it's always interesting when people can't remember. Galloway, you must go through that every now and then.
Never happens to me at all. Never, ever.
All right. We'll come back to that. Jim, we don't talk about a lot of national politics on this show because people get that in other places. But, by the way, June 11th, 1963, Todd Rehm, President Kennedy issued a proclamation ordering George Wallace of Alabama, the governor of Alabama, to allow two African-American students to register at the University of Alabama. He resisted at first, but when the troops showed up at his front door, he stood aside and let them come in, Jim.
Yeah, this was the end of the Stop Them at the Schoolhouse Door movement.
All right, so... So over the weekend, we know that the president came back from the G7 or left the G7 on his way to Singapore for his summit with Kim Jong-un. And he made some incredibly disparaging remarks about Justin Trudeau, the prime minister of Canada. He shook things up at the G7 by refusing to participate in what appeared to be a cooperative way. There's a photograph that has captured a lot of attention where the other G7 leaders are standing, hovering over him, and he's looking intransigent and belligerent.
And believe it or not, it's an accurate picture of both sides of the Trump and anti-Trump sentiment.
So the question is this. How are members of the Georgia Republican congressional delegation going to have to deal with this? I think that this is the sort of question that the Trump core will obviously celebrate this, But there are an awful lot of people who watch this and it troubles them a bit. If you are Karen Handel, if you're Rob Woodall in what are maybe vulnerable positions as you head for re-election, are you going to be able to speak out on this?
If President Trump goes deeper down this road, if he does impose that tariff on luxury car imports, that's going to be bad for Karen Handel. And probably Rob Woodall, because he's got a lot of those employees in his district as well. But even now, you have got farmers in South Georgia who are raising soybeans, or peaches, or blueberries, and those are going to be affected by the tariffs that Canadians are going to impose.
All right, so we know that, Mary Margaret. And in addition, though, now we're talking about a president who does not seem to be hesitant to attack other world leaders. And I just wonder, it'd be interesting to see what the polling on that will be. And is this something that Republicans are finally going to have to speak out against?
My long experience in politics tells me that the business community wants predictability more than anything else. We say all the time we're the best place for business to come to Georgia. It's based on predictability. The worst thing that Donald Trump does, in my view, is distress, disturb, disrupt any kind of predictability. If you're a timber farmer in Georgia, if you're trying to export chickens, this is a totally destructive action for our agricultural community. Where is Sonny Perdue going to be able to act in a way to save Georgia farmers, save Georgia timber growers from this kind of intentionally disruptive kind of behavior that is obviously based on name-calling and bad behavior?
Okay, but the question is it time that Republicans like a Karen Handel or a Rob Woodall are going to have to say something lest they lose voters who are on the edge here
tiptoed around last week, right, and mm-hmm. said something, but I don't know why a Republican voter. If you're a farmer in South Georgia, why would you vote for a Republican?
Kyle, what do you think?
I think this is a tightrope for them to walk. I think their Democratic opponents in the general election are going to, you know, put the pressure on them to say, how can Congress be a check on President Trump? They could lose voters from either the moderate flank or the right flank, because Martha Roby, woman from Alabama next door, she's gotten forced into a runoff in her primary challenge by a Republican over the endorsement that she pulled from President Trump during the 2016 election. So they've got pressure from both sides of their supporters on what you can say about the president.
Todd, if you had a Republican congressional incumbent in a district that might be trending a little purple, what would your advice be to them at this moment?
Avoid.
What a sigh that was.
Avoid a primary challenge, whatever you can, would be my advice to them. As far as one of the things that Representative Oliver said, Karen Handel, I don't think has to really worry about South Georgia votes because of where her district is.
Right.
And despite the fact that agriculture is the largest industry in the state, I don't think most voters in her district think of themselves as being supported by the agriculture industry, although there is some of that. And I think they're going to be more likely to be appalled if the price of
Mercedes
imported cars goes up.
I think maybe I have failed to frame this question, and so I'm going to throw it back to you, Todd. Here's what I'm asking about. Yes, there's all sorts of issues with the tariffs themselves that are going to disturb many Georgia voters. President Trump's decision to attack people like the Prime Minister of Canada, one of our closest allies for centuries, to come close to attacking Theresa May, Angela Merkel— is this behavior something that voters, other than his most adamant core, are going to be troubled about? And will people like Karen Handel have to speak up about it?
Of all the things that Donald Trump has said and tweeted over the years, I think his approach to foreign relations is the least worrisome to to Republican voters.
I think
you had more trouble with Republican primary voters and Republican general election voters when the focus was on questions about how he spoke about women.
Just foreign policy as a whole among both Democrats and Republicans generally isn't a topic that's going to move a voter, no matter what party they're in. Obviously, the more educated you are, the more attention you spend, you pay to foreign affairs. Bill, I would be hard. I would doubt that most people in the United States, most voters, couldn't even name the premier.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Of Canada.
Fair enough. We're just about out of time. I want to thank Mary Margaret Oliver. It's great to have you back. We haven't seen you for a while.
Thank you.
Keep coming. Todd Rehm, we haven't seen you either, and we're very happy to have you. Kyle Hayes from Washington, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and I hope you'll come back as well. Jim Galloway, see you again on Friday.
Absolutely.
We're back on Wednesday at 2 o'clock. I wanted to kind of get out of the conversation a little early because we're all talking about the partisanship, the hostility, the fights back and forth. I don't think many people in the audience have any doubts, because some of you listen to Two-Way Street, how much the theater means to me. Last night was the Tony Awards, and last night something kind of remarkable happened. The students from Stoneman Douglas High School appeared on the stage at the Tonys, the drama students. Their teacher was able, during the shooting as it unfolded, to protect 64 of her students in a classroom. She had just had a conversation with them prior to the shooting's beginning about the power of theater to bring us together. Last night at the Tony Awards, they came together, those students on stage, and sang one of the most beautiful songs in popular modern musical theater. 564,000 minutes. It's from Rent. As we go out, listen to the students sing this song. Thanks for being with us today.